Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler, translated by Thomas Dalton. Volume 1. A Reckoning. Chapter 3. General Political Reflections from My Time in Vienna. Today I am convinced that, in general, a man should not publicly take part in politics before the age of 30, except for cases of extraordinary talent. Until then, a man's mental development will mostly consist in acquiring the necessary knowledge to serve as the groundwork of a general platform, one from which he can evaluate different political problems. One must first acquire a fund of general ideas, a worldview. Then he will have that mental equipment necessary for consistency and steadfastness in the formation of his political opinions. He will then be qualified to take part in politics. Otherwise, he will run a twofold risk. He may find that his original position was wrong, at least regarding some essential questions. He will then either have to abandon his former position, or else stick with it, against his better judgment, and after reason has shown it untenable. In the former case, he will find himself in a difficult personal situation. He will appear inconsistent, and will lose the right to expect his followers to remain loyal. The followers themselves may see him as lacking in judgment, causing them to feel uncomfortable and nervous. In the second case, which happens frequently, the leader no longer has the power of personal persuasion. Hence the defense of his cause becomes hollow and superficial. He now becomes vulgar. He no longer fights seriously for his political ideas. No man will die in defense of something that he does not believe, and he makes increasing demands on his followers. Indeed, the greater his own insincerity, the more unfortunate and inconsiderate become his claims on his followers. Finally, he abandons the last vestiges of true leadership and becomes a politician. At this point, his only consistency is his inconsistency, combined with overbearing insolence and an artful lying, all developed to a shameful degree. If, to the misfortune of all decent people, such a person succeeds in becoming a parliamentarian, it will be clear at the outset that, for him, the essence of political activity consists in a heroic struggle to keep a permanent hold on this milk bottle for himself and his family. The more his wife and children are dependent on him, the more stubbornly he will fight to stay in office. For that reason, anyone else who shows signs of political competence is his personal enemy. In every new movement, he will sense the possible beginning of his own end. And anyone who is a better man than himself will appear to him as a danger. I shall have more to say later about this kind of parliamentary vermin. Section 3.1. The Politician. At the age of 30, a man obviously still has a great deal to learn. But henceforth, what he learns will principally be an amplification of his basic ideas, it will support his basic worldview. What he learns will not imply the abandonment of his principles, but rather a deeper knowledge of them. And thus his supporters will never have the uncomfortable feeling that they have been misled by him. On the contrary, their confidence will grow when they see that their leader's qualities are progressing and developing organically by the assimilation of new ideas. His followers will see this process as an enrichment of his doctrine, one that reinforces the correctness of the view. A leader who must abandon the platform founded on his general worldview, because he recognizes it as false, can only act honorably when he declares his readiness to accept the final consequences of his erroneous views. In such a case, he should refrain from any further political activity. Having once gone astray on essential matters, he may possibly go astray a second time. In any case, he has no right whatsoever to expect or demand that his fellow citizens continue to support him. How little such a line of conduct commends itself to our public leaders nowadays is proved by the general corruption prevalent among the present cabal, which feels itself called to political leadership. Overall, there is scarcely one who is prepared for this task. Even though, in those days, I used to give more time than most others to the consideration of political questions, I still carefully refrained from taking an open part in politics. I spoke of those things that bothered me, but only to a small circle of friends. This habit had many advantages. Rather than talk at them, I learned to listen, to get the feel of others' way of thinking. Often their outlook and views were quite primitive. But I trained myself well, without losing the time and opportunity for education. Nowhere in Germany was the opportunity for making such a study so favorable as in Vienna. In the old Danubian monarchy, political thought had a wider range and richer variety of interests than in old Germany of the same era, excepting certain parts of Prussia, Hamburg, and the districts bordering on the North Sea. When I say Austria, I mean that part of the great Habsburg Empire that supplied, through its German population, not only the historic basis for the formation of this state, but also whose population was, for several centuries, also the exclusive source of cultural life in that artificial political system. As time went on, the stability of the Austrian state and the guarantee of its continued existence depended more and more on the maintenance of this germ cell of the empire. Section 3.2. Vienna's last revival. The hereditary territories were the heart of the empire. And it was this heart that constantly sent the lifeblood pulsating through the whole political and cultural system. If this was the heart, Vienna was the brain and the will. At that time, Vienna appeared like an enthroned queen, whose authoritative sway united the conglomeration of heterogeneous nationalities. The radiant beauty of the capital city made one forget the sad symptoms of senile decay that were manifested in the state as a whole. Though the empire was quivering internally because of the conflicts among the various nationalities, the outside world, and Germany in particular, saw only that lovely picture of the city. The illusion was all the greater because, at that time, Vienna seemed to have experienced its greatest revival. Under a truly gifted mayor, one who had the stamp of administrative genius, the venerable residence of the emperor seemed to have recaptured the glory of its youth. The last great German who sprang from the ranks of the people that had colonized the Ostmark was not a so-called statesman. This Dr. Luger, in his role as mayor of the imperial capital Vienna, achieved so much in almost all spheres of municipal activity, both economic and cultural, that the heart of the empire throbbed with renewed energy. He thus proved himself a much greater statesman than the so-called diplomats of that period. Section 3.3. Germandom in Austria. The fact that this political system of heterogeneous nations called Austria finally broke down is no sign of political incapacity on the part of the Germans in the old Ostmark. The collapse was the inevitable result of an impossible situation. 10 million people cannot permanently hold together a state of 50 million, one composed of different and conflicting nationalities, unless certain definite prerequisite conditions are established in time. The German-Austrian had very big ways of thinking. Accustomed to living in a great empire, he had a strong sense of obligation. He was the only member of the Austrian state who looked beyond the narrow borders of his own people and took in the full sweep of the empire. When destiny severed him from his common fatherland, he tried to manage the tremendous task at hand. This task was to maintain for the German Austrians that which, through innumerable struggles, their ancestors had originally won from the East. And it must be remembered that they couldn't put their undivided strength into this effort, because their hearts and minds were always turning back towards their kinsfolk in the motherland, leaving only a small part for the homeland. The general horizon of the German-Austrian was comparatively broad. His commercial interests comprised almost every part of the heterogeneous empire. The conduct of nearly all major business activity was in his hands. For the most part, he provided the state with its leading technical experts and civil servants. He was responsible for conducting foreign trade, to the extent that that sphere of activity was not under Jewish control. He held the state together. His military duties carried him far beyond the narrow borders of his homeland. Though the recruit might join a German regiment, the regiment itself might be stationed in Herzegovina, Vienna, or Galicia. The officers in the Habsburg armies were still Germans, and so were the better parts of the civil service. Furthermore, art and science were in German hands. Apart from the new artistic trash, which might just as well have been produced by a nation of Negroes, all genuine artistic inspiration came from the Germans. In music, architecture, sculpture, and painting, Vienna abundantly supplied the entire dual monarchy. And this source never seemed to show signs of exhaustion. Finally, it was the German element that determined the conduct of foreign policy, though a small number of Hungarians were also active in that field. All efforts, however, to save the unity of the state were doomed to end in failure, because the essential prerequisites were missing. Section 3.4. Centrifugal forces of the Austrian people. There was only one possible way to control and hold in check the centrifugal forces of the differing nationalities. This was to centrally govern the Austrian state and organize it internally on this basis. In no other way could the existence of that state be assured. Now and then there were lucid moments in the ruling authorities when this truth was recognized. But it was quickly forgotten or ignored, because of the practical difficulties. Every step toward federalism was bound to fail because, without a strong central authority, there was insufficient power to hold the federal elements together. Conditions in Austria were quite the opposite. Apart from Hungary, there was no great political tradition in any of the various nations. If there were, time either erased all traces, or at least rendered them obscure. Moreover, this was the age of ascendant nationalism, the awakening of national instincts in the various countries of the empire. They were difficult to control because, just outside the borders of the empire, new national states were forming, consisting of the same racial stock as those within it. These new states were able to exercise a greater influence than the German element. Even Vienna couldn't hold out forever in this conflict. When Budapest developed into a metropolis, a rival appeared, one whose mission was to strengthen one part of the empire, and not to help hold it together. Soon Prague followed the example of Budapest, and later on came Lemberg, Liebeck, and others. As these former provincial towns rose to become national cities, they became the centers of an independent cultural life. Through this, local national instincts acquired a spiritual foundation and thereby gained a deeper hold on the people. The time was bound to come when the particular interests of those various nations would become stronger than their common imperial interests. Once that stage was reached, Austria's doom was sealed. The course of this development was clearly perceptible since the death of Joseph II. Note: Joseph II was Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire from 1765 to his death in 1790. End of the note. Its rapidity depended on a number of factors, some of which had their source in the monarchy itself. Others resulted from the position that the empire took in foreign policy. Only a firm and persistent policy of centralization could hope to be successful at enforcing a permanent consolidation of the Austrian state. Before all, the principle should have been adopted that only one common language could be used as the official language of the state. In this way, it would be possible to emphasize the formal unity of the imperial commonwealth. And thus the administration would have in its hands a technical instrument to ensure the persistence of the state as a political unity. In the same way, schools and other forms of education should have been used to inculcate a feeling of common citizenship. Such an objective could not be reached in 10 or 20 years, the effort would take centuries. Just as in all problems of colonization, steady perseverance is a far more important element than a momentary output of energetic effort. It goes without saying that, in such circumstances, the country must be governed by strictly adhering to the principle of uniformity. Section 3.5. Consequences of ethnic diversity. For me, it was quite instructive to discover why this did not occur, or rather, why it was not done. Those who were guilty of the omission must be held responsible for the breakup of the Habsburg Empire. More than any other state, the existence of the old Austria depended on a strong and capable government. It lacked ethnic uniformity. This constitutes the fundamental basis of a national state, and will preserve its existence even should the ruling power be grossly inefficient. When a state is composed of a homogeneous population, the natural inertia of such a population will hold it together and maintain its existence through astonishingly long periods of misgovernment and poor administration. It may often seem as if there were no life in such a body politic. But a time comes when the supposed corpse rises up and displays to the world an astonishing manifestation of its indestructible vitality. But the situation is utterly different in a country where the population is not homogeneous, where there is no bond of common blood, but only a ruling hand. Should that hand show signs of weakness, the result will not be a kind of hibernation of the state, but rather an awakening of the individual instincts that are slumbering in the various ethnicities. These instincts are dormant when the state has a strong central government. The danger that exists in these slumbering instincts can be attenuated only by centuries of common education, traditions, and interests. The younger such states are, the more their existence will depend on the ability and strength of the central government. If they survive only due to the power of a strong individual leader, they often collapse as soon as he dies. But even after centuries of effort, these separatist instincts cannot always be completely overcome. They may suddenly awaken when the central government shows weakness, or when centralizing efforts prove unable to counteract the vital energies of the separate nationalities, as they forge ahead towards shaping their own individual existence. The failure to see the truth of all this constituted perhaps the tragic guilt of the House of Habsburg. Section 3.6. Joseph II. For only one Habsburg ruler did destiny hold aloft the torch over the future of his country. But the torch was then extinguished forever. Joseph II, Roman Kaiser of the German nation, was filled with growing anxiety when he realized that his house was moved to an outlying comer of the Reich, and that before long it would be overturned and engulfed in the whirlpool of Babylonian nationalities, unless something was done at the 11th hour to overcome the dire consequences of long-standing negligence. With superhuman energy, this friend of humanity made every possible effort to counteract the carelessness of his predecessors. Within one decade, he strove to repair centuries of damage. If destiny had granted him 40 years for his labors, and if but two generations had carried on his work, the miracle might have been performed. But when he died, broken in body and spirit after 10 years of rulership, his work sank with him into the grave. They now rest forever in that Capuchin crypt, never to wake. His successors had neither the ability nor the willpower necessary for the task they faced. When the first signs of a new revolutionary epoch appeared in Europe, they gradually scattered the fire throughout Austria. And when the fire began to steadily burn, it was fanned, not by the social or political conditions, but by forces that had their origin in the nationalist yearnings of the various ethnic groups. The European revolutions of 1848 primarily took the form of a class conflict in almost every other country, but in Austria it took the form of a new racial struggle. Insofar as the German Austrians there forgot the origins of the movement, or perhaps had failed to recognize them at the start and consequently took part in the revolutionary uprising, they sealed their own fate. They helped to awaken the spirit of Western democracy that, within a short while, shattered the foundations of their own existence. Section 3.7. The dissolution of the Habsburg monarchy. Setting up a representative parliamentary body, without first insisting that only one language be used in all public discourse, was the first great blow to the German element in the dual monarchy. From that moment on, the state itself was lost. All that followed was nothing but the historic liquidation of an empire. To watch that process of progressive disintegration was a tragic but also instructive experience. The execution of history's decree was carried out in thousands of details. The fact that great numbers of people wandered around blindly, even as they were surrounded by signs of decay, only proves that the gods had decreed Austria's destruction. I don't want to dwell on details here, because that would lie outside the scope of this book. I want to treat in detail only those events that are typical among the causes that lead to the decline of nations and states, and which are therefore of importance to our present age. Moreover, the study of these events helped to furnish the basis of my own political outlook. Section 3.8. Parliamentarianism. Among the institutions that most clearly showed unmistakable signs of decay, even to the weak-sighted Philistine, was that which, of all the institutions of state, should have been the most firmly founded, I mean the Parliament, or Reichsrat, as it was called in Austria. The pattern for this corporate body was obviously that which existed in England, the land of classic democracy. The whole of that blissful organization was bodily transferred, unchanged, to Vienna. An Austrian counterpart to the British two-chamber system was established, a chamber of deputies and a house of lords. The houses themselves, considered as buildings, were somewhat different. When Barry built his palaces on the shore of the Thames, he could look to the history of the British Empire for his inspiration. Note: Charles Barry, 1795-1860, designed and rebuilt the Houses of Parliament in the mid-1800s. End of the note. In that history he found sufficient material to fill and decorate the 1200 niches, brackets, and pillars of his magnificent edifice. The House of Lords and the House of Commons became temples dedicated to the glory of the nation. This was when the first difficulty came for Vienna. When Theophil Hansen, the Danish architect, completed the last gable of the Marble Palace, he turned to the ancient classical world for subjects to fill out his decorative plan. This theatrical shrine of Western democracy was adorned with the statues and portraits of Greek and Roman statesmen and philosophers. As if in symbolic irony, the horses of the quadriga atop the two houses are pulling apart in all four directions. There could be no better symbol for the kind of activity going on within the walls of that very building. The nationalities were opposed to any kind of glorification of Austrian history in the decoration of this building. They insisted that it would constitute an offense to them. Much the same happened in Germany, where Wallow's Reichstag building was dedicated to the Germans only under the thunder of cannons in the World War, and then only in an inscription. I was not yet 20 when I first entered the palace on the Franzensring to watch and listen in the Chamber of Deputies. That first experience aroused in me a profound feeling of repugnance. I always hated the Parliament, but not as an institution in itself. On the contrary, as one who cherished ideals of political freedom, I couldn't even imagine any other form of government. In light of my attitude towards the House of Habsburg, I would then have thought it a crime against liberty and reason to consider any kind of dictatorship as a possible form of government. I had a certain admiration for the British Parliament, and this contributed to the formation of my opinion. This feeling came almost unconsciously, much of it while reading the newspapers when I was young. I couldn't discard that admiration in an instant. The dignified way in which the British House of Commons fulfilled its function impressed me greatly, thanks largely to the glowing terms used by the Austrian press. Could there be any nobler form of government than self-government by the people? But these considerations furnished the very basis of my hostility to the Austrian Parliament. The way it was represented here seemed unworthy of its great example. The following thoughts also influenced my attitude. The fate of the Germans in the Austrian state depended on their position in the Reichsrat. Prior to the introduction of universal suffrage by secret ballot, the Germans had a majority in the Reichsrat, though not a very substantial one. This was a cause for concern because the social democratic faction of the German majority was unreliable regarding national questions. In matters of critical concern to the Germans, the Social Democrats always took an anti-German stand because they were afraid of losing support among the other national groups. Even before universal suffrage, the Social Democratic Party could no longer be considered a German party. Universal suffrage put an end even to the purely numerical dominance of the German element. The way was now clear for the further de-Germanization of the state. My nationalist instinct of self-preservation made it impossible for me to welcome a system in which the German element was not really represented as such, but always betrayed by the Social Democratic faction. Yet all these defects, and many others, could not be attributed to the parliamentary system as such, but rather to the Austrian state in particular. I still believed that if the German majority could be restored in the representative body, there would be no occasion to oppose such a system as long as the old Austrian state continued to exist. Such was my general attitude at the time when I first entered those sacred and contentious halls. For me, they were sacred only because of the radiant beauty of that majestic building. A Greek wonder on German soil. But I soon became enraged by the hideous spectacle that met my eyes. Several hundred representatives were there to discuss a problem of great economic importance, and each one had the right to have his say. That experience of a single day was enough to supply me with food for thought during several weeks afterwards. The intellectual level of the debate was quite low. Sometimes the debaters didn't make themselves intelligible at all. Several of those present didn't speak German, but only their Slav vernaculars or dialects. Thus I had the opportunity of hearing with my own ears what I had previously known only by reading the newspapers. A turbulent mass of people, all gesticulating and screaming at one another, with a pathetic old man shaking his bell and making frantic efforts to call the house to order by friendly appeals, exhortations, and grave warnings. Note: interestingly, Mark Twain made a similar observation just a decade before. In the nonfiction essay, Stirring Times in Austria, 1898, he lampoons the chaotic and sorry state of the Austrian Parliament. Notably, he remarks on how all sides found the Jews to blame for their problems, in all cases the Jew had to roast, no matter which side he was on. A follow-up essay, Concerning the Jews, from 1899, is also relevant for the discussion at hand. End of the note. I had to laugh. I paid a second visit several weeks later. It was an entirely different picture, almost unrecognizable. The hall was nearly empty. They were sleeping in the other rooms below. Only a few deputies were in their places, yawning in each other's faces. One was speaking. A deputy speaker was in the chair. He looked around with obvious boredom. Then I began to reflect seriously on the whole thing. I went to the parliament whenever I had any time to spare, and silently but attentively watched the spectacle. I listened to the debates, as far as they could be understood. And I studied the more or less intelligent features of those elected representatives of the various nationalities that composed that motley state. Gradually I formed my own ideas about what I saw. A year of such quiet observation was sufficient to transform or completely eliminate my former convictions regarding the character of this institution. I no longer opposed merely the perverted form that the principle of parliamentary representation had assumed in Austria, no. It became impossible for me to accept the system in itself. Up to that time, I had believed that the disastrous deficiencies of the Austrian parliament were due to the lack of a German majority. But now I recognized that the very essence and form of the institution itself was wrong. A number of questions arose in my mind. I studied the democratic principle of majority rule more closely. And I scrutinized no less carefully the intellectual and moral worth of the gentlemen who, as the chosen representatives of the nation, were entrusted with the task of making this institution function. Thus I came to know both the institution itself and those in it. And thus I formed a clear and vivid picture of a typical example of that most dignified phenomenon of our time, the parliamentarian. The picture of him that I then formed became deeply engraved on my mind, and I have never altered its essential character. Once again, these object lessons taken from real life saved me from getting firmly entangled by a theory that, at first glance, seems so alluring to many people, though that theory itself is a symptom of human decadence. Western democracy, as practiced today, is the forerunner of Marxism. In fact, the latter would be inconceivable without the former. Democracy is the breeding ground in which the bacilli of the Marxist world pest can grow and spread. By the introduction of parliamentarianism, democracy produced an abomination of filth and fire, the creative fire of which, however, seems to have died out. Note: abomination of filth and fire is a reference to Goethe's Faust. End of the note. I'm very grateful to fate that I noticed this problem when I was still in Vienna. If I had been in Germany at that time, I might easily have found only a superficial solution. If I had been in Berlin when I first discovered what an illogical institution parliament is, I might easily have gone to the other extreme. I might have believed, as many did, and not without apparently good reason, that the salvation of the people and the empire could be secured only by re-strengthening imperial authority. Those who believed didn't understand the tendencies of their time, and were blind to the aspirations of the people. In Austria, this was impossible. Here it wasn't so easy to fall from one error into another. If the parliament was worthless, the Habsburgs were worse, or at least no better. The problem wasn't solved by rejecting the parliamentary system. A question immediately arose: what then? To repudiate and abolish the Vienna parliament would have resulted in leaving all power in the hands of the Habsburgs. For me especially, that idea was unthinkable. Since this problem was particularly difficult in regard to Austria, I was forced, while still quite young, to go more thoroughly into the essentials of the whole question than I would otherwise have done. Section 3.9. Lack of responsibility. The aspect of the situation that was most thought-provoking to me was the manifest lack of any individual responsibility. The parliament takes an action that may have the most devastating consequences, and yet nobody bears responsibility for it. No one can be called to account. Can we call the government responsible if, in the face of a catastrophe, it simply resigns? Or if the coalition is changed, or even if parliament is dissolved? Can a fluctuating majority of people ever be truly responsible for anything? Isn't the idea of responsibility bound to an individual person? Is it even possible to actually hold the parliamentary leaders accountable for any action that originated in the desires of the mass of representatives, and was carried out under their direction? Instead of developing constructive ideas and plans, does the true statesman's business really consist in the art of making a whole pack of blockheads understand his projects? Is it really his job to beg and plead so that they will grant him their generous consent? Is it really an indispensable quality in a statesman that he should possess a gift of persuasion commensurate with his ability to conceive great political measures, and to carry them through into practice? Does it really prove that a statesman is incompetent if he should fail to win over a majority of votes in an assembly that has been called together as the chance result of an electoral system? Has there ever been a case where such an assembly has worthily appraised a great political concept before that concept was proven a success? In this world, isn't the creative act of genius always a protest against the inertia of the mass? And what should the statesman do if he doesn't succeed in coaxing the parliamentary mob to give its consent? Should he buy it? Or, when confronted with the obstinate stupidity of his fellow citizens, should he then refrain from pushing forward the vital necessities? Should he resign or remain in power? In such a case, doesn't a man of character find himself face to face with an insoluble contradiction between knowledge and moral integrity, or better, his sense of honesty? Section 3.10. The destruction of the idea of leadership. Where can we draw the line between public duty and personal honor? Shouldn't every genuine leader renounce the idea of degrading himself to the level of a political gangster? And, on the other hand, doesn't every gangster feel the itch to play politics, seeing that the final responsibility will never rest with him personally but rather with an anonymous, unaccountable mob? Doesn't our parliamentary principle of majority rule necessarily lead to the destruction of the idea of leadership? Does anyone honestly believe that human progress originates in the brain of the majority and not in the brain of the individual personality? Or may it be presumed that future human civilization can dispense with this as a condition of its existence? Or rather, doesn't this seem today to be more indispensable than ever? The parliamentary principle of majority rule rejects the authority of the individual and puts a numerical quota of anonymous heads in its place. In doing so, it contradicts the aristocratic principle, which is a fundamental law of nature, though it must be admitted that this principle is not reflected in the decadence of our upper 10,000. Note, in other words, of the 1%. End of the note. The devastating influence of this parliamentary institution might not easily be recognized by those who read the Jewish press, unless the reader has learned how to think independently and examine facts for himself. This institution is primarily responsible for the crowded inrush of mediocre people into the field of politics. Confronted with such a phenomenon, a man who is endowed with real qualities of leadership will be tempted to refrain from taking part in politics. Under these circumstances, the situation doesn't call for a man who has a capacity for constructive statesmanship, but rather for a man who is capable of bargaining for the favor of the majority. The situation appeals to small minds, and it attracts them accordingly. The narrower the spirit and knowledge of our leather handlers, the more accurately can they assess their own situation. They will therefore be all the more inclined to praise a system that doesn't demand creative genius or even high-class talent, but rather the craftiness of an efficient town clerk. Indeed, they value this kind of petty craftiness more than the political genius of a Pericles. Note: Pericles, about 495 about 429 BC, was one of the great Athenian statesmen. End of the note. Such mediocrity never worries about responsibility. From the beginning, our parliamentarian knows that, whatever be the results of his statesmanship, his end is already written in the stars. One day, he will have to clear out and make room for another equally great spirit. It's a sign of our decadent times that the number of eminent statesmen grows as the caliber of individual personality dwindles. That caliber will inevitably shrink as the individual politician increasingly depends upon parliamentary majorities. A man of real political ability will refuse to be the lackey of idiotic incompetence and big mouths. And they in turn, being the representatives of the majority, and hence of stupidity, hate nothing so much as a superior mind. For such an assembly of wise men, it's always a consolation to be led by a person whose intellectual stature is on par with their own. Thus each one may have the occasional opportunity to shine in debate, and above all, each one feels that he too may rise to the top. If Peter be boss today, then why not Paul tomorrow? Section 3.11. The exclusion of the individual leader. This invention of democracy is very closely connected with a peculiar phenomenon that has recently become a real disgrace, namely, the cowardice of a large section of our so-called political leaders. Whenever important decisions must be made, they always find themselves fortunate in being able to hide behind the so-called majority. In observing one of these political manipulators, one notices how he begs the majority for their approval for whatever action he takes. He needs to have accomplices, in order to shift responsibility to other shoulders whenever it is convenient to do so. That's the main reason why this kind of political activity is abhorrent to men of character and courage. At the same time, it attracts inferior types, for a person who is not willing to accept responsibility for his own actions, but is always seeking to hide, is a cowardly scoundrel. Whenever a national leader comes from that low class of politicians, evil consequences will soon follow. No one will then have the courage to take a decisive step. They will submit to abuse and defamation rather than rise up and take a stand. And thus nobody is left who is willing to risk his position and his career, if necessary, in support of a determined line of policy. One truth must always be kept in mind: the majority can never replace the man. The majority represents not only ignorance but also cowardice. And just as 100 blockheads don't equal one wise man, so 100 cowards are incapable of any heroic action. The lighter the burden of responsibility on each individual leader, the greater will be the number of those who, in spite of their sorry mediocrity, will come to place their immortal energies at the service of the nation. They are so anxious that they find it hard to wait their turn. They stand in a long line, painfully and sadly counting the number of those ahead of them, and calculating the hours until their turn comes. They watch every change in personnel, and they are grateful for every scandal that thins the ranks ahead of them. And if someone sticks to his stool too long, they consider this as almost a breach of a holy pact of solidarity. They grow vindictive, and don't rest until that inconsiderate person is finally driven out and forced to hand over his cozy berth back to the public. After that, he will have little chance of getting another opportunity. Usually those creatures who have been forced to give up their posts try to get in line again, unless they are hounded away by the protests of the others. The result of all this is that, in such a state, the succession of sudden changes in public offices has a very troubling effect in general, one that may easily lead to disaster. It's not only the ignorant and the incompetent person who may fall victim to those parliamentary conditions, the genuine leader may be affected just as much as the others, if not more so, whenever fate has placed a capable man in a leadership position. If the superior quality of such a leader becomes recognized, it will result in a united front against him, particularly if that leader, though not coming from their ranks, should fall into the habit of intermingling with this exalted society. They want to have only their own types as company, and they will quickly take a hostile attitude towards any man who might show himself superior to them. Their instinct, which is so blind in other ways, is very sharp in this respect. The inevitable result is that the intellectual level of the ruling class steadily declines. One can easily predict how much the nation and state are bound to suffer from such a condition, provided one doesn't belong to that same class of leaders. The parliamentary regime in the old Austria was the purest form of this institution. Though the Austrian prime minister was appointed by the emperor and king, this act of appointment merely gave practical effect to the parliamentary will. The huckstering and bargaining that went on in regard to every ministerial position showed all the typical marks of Western democracy. The results that followed were in keeping with the principles applied. The intervals between the replacement of one person by another gradually became shorter, finally ending up in a veritable chase. With each change, the quality of the statesman in question deteriorated, until finally only the petty type of political gangster remained. In such people, the qualities of statesmanship were measured and valued according to the skill with which they pieced together one coalition after another, in other words, their craftiness in manipulating the pettiest political transactions, which is the only kind of practical activity suited to the aptitudes of these representatives. In this sphere, Vienna was the school that offered the most impressive examples. Another feature that engaged my attention even more was the contrast between the talents and knowledge of these representatives of the people on the one hand and, on the other, the nature of the tasks they had to face. Willingly or unwillingly, one couldn't help thinking seriously of the narrow intellectual outlook of these chosen representatives of the various nationalities. And one couldn't avoid contemplating the methods through which these noble figures in our public life were first discovered. It was worthwhile to make a thorough study of the way in which the real talents of these gentlemen were devoted to the service of their country, in other words, to thoroughly analyze the technical process of their activities. The more I penetrated into the intimate structure of parliamentary life, and the more I studied the persons and principles of the system in a spirit of ruthless objectivity, the more deplorable it became. Indeed, it's mandatory to be strictly objective in the study of an institution whose sponsors speak of objectivity as the only fair basis of examination and judgment. If one studied these gentlemen and the laws of their sordid existence, the results were surprising. Section 3.12. Public Opinion. Objectively considered, there is no other principle that turns out to be quite so ill-conceived as parliamentarianism. Here we may pass over the methods according to which the election of the representatives takes place, as well as the ways that bring them into office and bestow new titles on them. It is quite evident that public wishes are satisfied only to a small degree by the manner in which an election takes place. Everyone who properly estimates the political intelligence of the masses can easily see that it is insufficient to independently form a general political outlook, or to select the men who might be competent to carry out their ideas. Whatever definition we may give of the term public opinion, only a very small part of it originates from personal experience or individual insight. The greater portion results from the manner in which public matters have been presented to the people, through an overwhelmingly impressive and persistent system of information. In the theological sphere, religious yearnings slumber in the soul, and the profession of a denominational belief is largely the result of education. So too, the political opinions of the masses are the final result of influences systematically operating on the human soul and intelligence, in light of a method that is applied with unbelievable thoroughness and perseverance. By far the most effective branch of political education, that which is best expressed by the word propaganda, is conducted by the press. The press is the chief means employed in the process of political enlightenment. It represents a kind of school for adults. This educational activity, however, is not in the hands of the state but in the clutches of powers that are of a very inferior character. While still a young man in Vienna, I had excellent opportunities for coming to know the men who owned this machine for mass instruction, as well as those who supplied it with ideas. At first I was quite surprised when I realized how little time was necessary for this great evil power within the state to produce a certain belief among the public. In doing so, the genuine will and convictions of the public were often completely misconstrued. It took the press only a few days to transform some ridiculously trivial matter into an issue of national importance, while vital problems were completely ignored or hidden away from public view. The press succeeded in the magical art of producing names from nowhere within just a few weeks. They made it appear that the great hopes of the masses were bound up with those names. And so they made those names more popular than any man of real ability could ever hope for. All this was done, despite the fact that such names were utterly unknown, even up to a month before the press publicly extolled them. At the same time, older figures in politics and other spheres of life quickly faded from the public memory, and were forgotten as if they were dead, though they were still vigorous and healthy. Or they were so vilely abused that it looked as if their names would soon stand as permanent symbols of villainy. To understand the really pernicious influence that the press can exercise, one must study this infamous Jewish method whereby honorable and decent people are besmirched with filth, in the lowest form of abuse and slander, from hundreds of directions simultaneously, as if by magic. These spiritual robbers will grab at anything that might serve their evil ends. They would poke their noses into the most intimate family affairs, and not rest until they had sniffed out some petty issue that could be used to destroy the victim's reputation. But even if nothing were discovered in the private or public life of the victim, they continued to hurl abuse at him in the belief that some of their charges would stick, even though refuted 1,000 times. In most cases, it finally became impossible for the victim to continue his defense because the accuser worked together with so many accomplices that his slanders were repeated interminably. But these slanderers would never admit that they were acting from motives that were believable or comprehensible to the common run of humanity. God forbid. The scoundrel who defamed his contemporaries in this villainous way would, like an octopus, cover himself with a cloud of respectability and clever phrases about his journalistic duty and other such nonsense. When these pests gathered together in large numbers at meetings and congresses, they would dish out a lot of slimy talk about a special kind of honor, namely, the professional honor of the journalist. Then the assembled species would bow their respects to one another. This rabble fabricates more than 2/3 of the so-called public opinion, from whose foam the parliamentary Aphrodite eventually arises. Note: the name Aphrodite means literally foam risen. In Greek mythology, Aphrodite arose from the foam of the sea. End of the note. Section 3.13. The majority principle. Several volumes would be needed if one were to give an adequate account of all its hollow fallacies. But if we pass over the details and look at the product itself while in operation, I think this alone will suffice to open the eyes of even the most innocent and naive person, so that he may recognize the absurdity of this institution by looking at it objectively. This human aberration is as harmful as it is absurd. In order to see this, the best and easiest method is to compare democratic parliamentarianism with a genuine German democracy. The remarkable characteristic of the parliamentary form of democracy is the fact that a number of persons, let us say 500, these days, including women also, are elected to parliament and invested with authority to give final judgment on everything. In practice, they alone are the governing body, for although they may appoint a cabinet that outwardly seems to direct state affairs, this cabinet has no real existence of its own. In reality, this so-called government can't do anything against the will of the assembly. It can never be called to account for anything, since the right of decision is not vested in the cabinet but in the parliamentary majority. The cabinet always functions only as the executor of the will of the majority. Its political ability can be judged only by how far it succeeds in adapting to the will of the majority, or in persuading the majority to agree to its proposals. But this means that it must descend from the level of a real governing power to that of a beggar, one who has to beg for the approval of a majority. Indeed, the main job of the cabinet is to secure for itself the favor of the majority then in power or, failing that, to form a new majority that will be more favorably disposed. If it should succeed in either of these efforts, it may go on governing for a little while. If it should fail to win or form a majority, it must resign. Whether its policy per se was right or wrong doesn't matter at all. For all practical purposes, responsibility is abolished. The consequences of such a state of affairs can easily be understood from the following simple considerations. Those 500 deputies who have been elected by the people come from various dissimilar callings in life. They show widely varying degrees of political capacity, with the result that the whole picture is incoherent and deplorable. Surely nobody believes that these elected representatives of the nation are the choice spirits or first-class intellects. No one, I hope, is foolish enough to pretend that hundreds of true statesmen can emerge from papers placed in the ballot box by voters who are just of average intelligence. The absurd notion that men of genius are born out of universal suffrage cannot be too strongly repudiated. In the first place, those times may be really called blessed when one genuine statesman appears among a people. Such statesmen don't appear by the hundreds or more. Secondly, the broad masses instinctively display a definite antipathy towards every outstanding genius. There's a better chance of a camel passing through the eye of a needle than of a truly great man being discovered through an election. Throughout world history, exceptional events have mostly been due to the driving force of an individual personality. But here, 500 persons of subpar intellectual qualities pass judgment on the most important problems affecting the nation. They form governments that in turn learn to win the approval of the illustrious assembly for every legislative step, which means that the policy to be carried out is actually the policy of the 500. And that's just what it usually looks like. But let's pass over the intellectual qualities of these representatives and ask what is the nature of the task set before them. If we consider the fact that the problems to be addressed are variable and diverse, we can very well realize how inefficient a governing system must be that entrusts the right of decision to a mass assembly, one in which only very few possess the requisite knowledge and experience to properly deal with the matters. The most important economic measures are submitted to a tribunal in which not more than 10% have studied economics. This means that final authority is vested in men who are utterly devoid of any preparatory training that would make them competent to decide on the questions at hand. The same holds true of every other problem. It's always a majority of ignorant and incompetent people who decide on each measure. The composition of the institution does not change, while the problems to be dealt with come from the most varied spheres of public life. An intelligent judgment would be possible only if different deputies had the authority to deal with different issues. It's out of the question to think that the same people are qualified to decide on transportation questions as well as, say, on questions of foreign policy, unless each is a universal genius. But scarcely more than one true genius appears in a century. Here we are scarcely ever dealing with real thinkers, but only with dilettantes who are as narrow-minded as they are conceited and arrogant, intellectual prostitutes of the worst kind. That's why these honorable gentlemen show such astonishing levity in debating matters that would demand the most painstaking consideration, even from great minds. Measures of momentous importance for the future existence of the state are discussed in an atmosphere more suited to the card table. Indeed, the latter would be a much more fitting occupation for these gentlemen than that of deciding the destinies of a race. Of course, it would be unfair to assume that every member in such a parliament was endowed by nature with such a small sense of responsibility. No, by no means. Section 3.14. The destruction of character. But this system, by forcing the individual to pass judgment on questions for which he is not competent, gradually debases his moral character. Nobody will have the courage to say, "Gentlemen, I'm afraid we know nothing about what we are talking about. I, for one, have no competency in the matter at all." Besides, if such a declaration were made, it wouldn't change matters very much, such outspoken honesty would not be understood. The person who made the declaration would be deemed an honorable ass who shouldn't be allowed to spoil the game. Those who know human nature know that nobody likes to be considered a fool among his associates, and in certain circles, honesty is taken as a measure of stupidity. Thus, even a man who was originally honest, once he finds himself elected to Parliament, may eventually be forced to acquiesce in a line of conduct that is base in itself, and which amounts to a betrayal of the public trust. This destroys every real sense of honor that might occasionally rise up in the conscience of one person or another. Finally, the otherwise upright deputy will succeed in persuading himself that he is by no means the worst of the lot, and that by playing along, he may prevent something worse from happening. An objection may be raised here. It may be said that, of course, the individual member may not have a knowledge of what's required for addressing this or that question. But in such a case, the party sets up special committees of experts who have more than the required knowledge for dealing with the questions before them. At first glance, that argument seems sound. But then another question arises, namely, why are 500 persons elected if only a few have the wisdom that is required to deal with the more important problems? Yes, this is the worm in the apple. Section 3.15. Jewish democracy. It isn't the aim of our modern democratic parliamentary system to bring together an assembly of intelligent and well-informed men. The aim rather is to bring together a group of non-entities who are dependent on others for their views, and who can be all the more easily led, the narrower their mental outlook. This is the only way that party policy, according to the evil meaning it has today, can be put into effect. Only in this way is it possible for the wire puller, who exercises real control, to remain in the dark, so that he personally can never be held accountable. Under such circumstances, none of the decisions taken, no matter how disastrous they may be, can be laid at the foot of the scoundrel who is truly to blame. All responsibility is shifted to the shoulders of the party as a whole. In practice, no actual responsibility remains. It arises only from personal duty and not from the obligations that rest with a parliamentary assembly of empty talkers. The parliamentary institution attracts liars and moles, people who shun the light of day. No upright man, who is ready to accept personal responsibility for his acts, will be attracted to such an institution. That's the reason why this brand of democracy has become a tool in the hand of that race that, because of its inner goals, must shun the open light, as it has always done and always will do. Only the Jew can praise an institution which is as corrupt and false as himself. By contrast, consider a truly German democracy. Here the leader is freely chosen and is obliged to accept full responsibility for all his actions and omissions. Problems are not put to a majority vote, but they are decided upon by the individual. As a guarantee of responsibility for those decisions, he pledges his worldly belongings and even his life. The objection may be raised here that, under such conditions, it would be very difficult to find a man who would be ready to devote himself to so risky a task. There is only one answer to that. Thank God that our German democracy will prevent the chance careerist, who may be intellectually worthless and a moral slacker, from coming to power in devious ways. The fear of undertaking such far-reaching responsibilities, under German democracy, will scare off the ignorant and the incompetent. But if it happens that such a person sneaks in, it will be easy enough to ruthlessly identify and challenge him, somewhat as follows: "Be gone, you scoundrel. Don't soil these steps with your feet. These are the steps of the pantheon of history, and they are not meant for status seekers but for men of noble character." Such were the views I formed after 2 years of attending the sessions of the Viennese Parliament. Then I never went back. Section 3.16. The collapsing dual monarchy. The parliamentary regime was one of the chief reasons why the Habsburg state steadily declined during its final years. The more that the German element was whittled away through parliamentary procedure, the stronger was the system of playing off the various constituent nationalities against the other. In the Reichsrat, this always occurred at the expense of the Germans, which meant that the results were detrimental to the empire as a whole. At the close of the century, even a simpleton could see that the cohesive forces in the dual monarchy could no longer counterbalance the separatist tendencies of the provincial nationalities. On the contrary, the measures that the state adopted for its own maintenance became increasingly mean-spirited. Correspondingly, general disrespect for the state increased. Hungary and the various Slav provinces gradually ceased to identify themselves with the unified monarchy, and therefore they didn't feel its weakness as in any way detrimental to themselves. Rather, they welcomed those symptoms of decay. They looked forward to the final dissolution of the state, not to its recovery. Complete collapse was temporarily averted in Parliament by the humiliating concessions that were made to all kinds of annoying demands, at the expense of the Germans. Everywhere the defense of the state rested on playing off the various nationalities against one another. But the general trend of this development was always directed against the Germans. Given that the right of royal succession gave a certain influence to the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, a policy of increasing the power of the Czechs was systematically enacted throughout the administration. Note: Franz Ferdinand supported equal representation for the Slavic nations of the empire. His assassination on the 28th of June 1914 precipitated World War I. End of the note. With all the means at his disposal, the heir to the dual monarchy personally furthered a policy aimed at eliminating the influence of the Germans, or at least he defended that policy. Purely German districts were gradually but decisively brought within the danger zone of the mixed languages. Even in Lower Austria, this process began to make increasingly rapid progress, and Vienna was looked upon by the Czechs as their largest city. The central idea of this new Habsburg was to establish a Slavic state in Central Europe. The Czech language was favored. The Archduke's wife had formerly been a Czech countess, and she was wedded to the prince by an arranged marriage. She came from an environment of traditional hostility to the Germans. This new state was to be constructed on a purely Catholic basis, so as to serve as a bulwark against Orthodox Russia. As had happened often in Habsburg history, religion was thus exploited to serve a purely political policy, and in this case, a fatal policy, at least for the Germans. The result was lamentable in many respects. Neither the House of Habsburg nor the Catholic Church received the reward that they expected. Habsburg lost the throne, and the church lost a great state. By employing religious motives in the service of politics, a spirit was aroused that the instigators had never thought possible. The attempt to root out Germandom in the old monarchy led to the emergence of the pan-German movement in Austria. In the 1880s, Manchester liberalism, which was fundamentally Jewish in its outlook, had reached or even passed the zenith of its influence in the dual monarchy. Note: Manchester liberalism was an economic school of thought that originated in Manchester, England, in the mid-19th century. It was Jewish insofar as it promoted free trade and globalism generally. End of the note. The reaction that set in arose not from social but from nationalistic tendencies, as was always the case in old Austria. The instinct for self-preservation drove the Germans to vigorously defend themselves. Economic considerations only slowly began to grow in influence, but they were of secondary concern. But of the general political chaos, two party organizations emerged. The one was more of a national character, and the other more social. Both were highly interesting and instructive for the future. After the humiliating end of the War of 1866, the House of Habsburg contemplated a military revenge. Note: the War of 1866 was essentially a German civil war, in which Prussia triumphed over the Austrian Germans. End of the note. Only the tragic death of Emperor Maximilian of Mexico prevented a still closer collaboration with France. The chief blame for Maximilian's disastrous expedition was attributed to Napoleon III. The fact that the French abandoned him aroused a general feeling of indignation. Yet the Habsburgs were still lying in wait for their opportunity. If the War of 1870-71 had not been such a singular triumph, the Viennese court might have risked a bloody venture in order to avenge Sadowa. Note: The War of 1870, also known as the Franco-Prussian War, resulted in German victory, the fall of Paris, and the absorption of Alsace-Lorraine into the German Empire. Sadowa, Königgrätz in German, is present-day Sadova, in the Czech Republic. It was the decisive battle in the war, and ended in Prussian victory. End of the note. But when the first reports arrived from the Franco-German battlefield, which, though true, seemed miraculous and almost incredible, the wisest of all monarchs recognized that it was an inopportune moment, and tried to put the best face on a bad situation. The heroic conflict of those 2 years, that is, 1870-71, produced an even greater miracle. With the Habsburgs, the change of attitude came only from the pressure of circumstances, never from a heartfelt urge. The German people of the Ostmark, however, were entranced by the triumphant glory of the newly established German Reich, and were profoundly moved when they saw the dream of their fathers resurrected in a glorious reality. Let there be no mistake, the true German-Austrian realized, from this time onward, that Königgrätz was the tragic but necessary precondition for the re-establishment of an empire that would no longer be burdened with the morbidity of the old alliance. Above all, the German-Austrian came to feel, in the very depths of his own being, that the historic mission of the House of Habsburg had come to an end, and that the new empire could choose only a Kaiser whose heroic convictions were worthy to wear the crown of the Rhine. It was right and just that destiny be praised for having chosen a scion of that house which, in Frederick the Great, gave the nation an elevated and shining symbol for all time to come. Section 3.17. Rebellion of the German-Austrians. After the Great War of 1870-71, the House of Habsburg desperately set to work to slowly and deliberately root out the dangerous German element, whose inner feelings and attitude could not be doubted. Such a process would be the final result of the Slavization policy. It was then that the fire of rebellion burned among the doomed people, such as has never been seen in modern German history. For the first time, nationalists and patriots were transformed into rebels. Not rebels against the nation or the state as such, but rebels against that form of government that they were convinced would inevitably bring about the ruin of their own people. For the first time in modern history, the traditional dynastic patriotism and national love of fatherland and people were in open conflict. It was to the merit of the pan-German movement in Austria during the 1890s that it pointed out clearly and unequivocally that a state is entitled to demand respect and protection only when it is administered in accordance with the interests of the nation, or at least not in a manner detrimental to those interests. The authority of the state can never be an end in itself. If that were so, any kind of tyranny would be inviolable and sacred. If a government uses the instruments of power in its hands for the purpose of leading a people to ruin, then rebellion is not only the right of every individual citizen, it is his duty. The question of whether and when such a situation exists cannot be answered by theoretical dissertations, but only by the exercise of force, and it is success that decides the issue. Every government, even one that is the worst possible, and even though it may have betrayed the nation's trust in a thousand ways, will claim that its duty is to uphold the authority of the state. Its adversaries, who are fighting for national self-preservation, must use the same weapons that the government uses, if they are to prevail against such a rule and secure their own freedom and independence. Therefore, the conflict will be fought with legal means as long as the power to be overthrown uses them. But the insurgents won't hesitate to apply illegal means if the oppressor himself uses them. Generally speaking, we must not forget that the highest aim of human existence is not the maintenance of a state of government, but rather the preservation of the species. Section 3.18. Human rights override states' rights. If the species is in danger of being oppressed or even eliminated, the question of legality is only of secondary importance. The established power may, in such a case, employ only those means that are alleged to be legal. And yet the instinct of self-preservation on the part of the oppressed will always justify, to the greater degree, the use of all possible resources. Only on the basis of this principle was it possible to conduct those struggles against foreign enslavement or domestic oppression, of which history supplies us with many magnificent examples. Human rights surpass the rights of the state. But if a people be defeated in the struggle for its human rights, this means that its weight has proved too light in the scale of destiny to be worthy of survival on this earth. When a people is unwilling or unable to fight for its existence, then Providence, in its eternal justice, will decree that people's end. The world is not here for cowards. Austria affords a very clear and striking example of how easy it is for tyranny to hide its head under the cloak of so-called legality. The legal exercise of power in the Habsburg state was then based on the anti-German attitude of the parliament, with its non-German majorities, and on the dynastic house, which was also hostile to the German element. The whole authority of the state was incorporated in these two factors. Any attempt to alter the lot of the Germans through these two factors would have been absurd. Those who advised the legal way as the only possible means offered no resistance. No policy of resistance could have been put into effect through legal measures. To follow the advice of the legalist counselors would have meant the inevitable ruin of the German element within the monarchy. And this disaster would have come very soon. The Germans were actually saved only by the collapse of the state. The spectacled theorist would still rather die for his doctrine than for his people. Because men have made laws, he subsequently comes to think that they exist for the sake of the laws. The pan-German movement rendered a great service by abolishing all such nonsense, to the horror of all doctrinaire theorists and other fetish worshippers. When the Habsburgs attempted to attack the German element through all available means, the pan-German party hit back ruthlessly against the illustrious dynasty. This party was the first to probe into the corrupt condition of the state. In doing so, they opened the eyes of hundreds of thousands. To its credit, it liberated the high ideal of love for one's country from the embrace of this deplorable dynasty. When that party first made its appearance, it secured a large following, in fact, almost an avalanche. But the initial successes didn't last. When I came to Vienna, the pan-German party had been eclipsed by the Christian Socialist Party, which had meanwhile come into power. Indeed, the pan-German party had been reduced to almost complete insignificance. The rise and fall of the pan-German movement on the one hand, and the unprecedented progress of the Christian Socialist Party on the other, became a classic object of study for me. They played an important part in the development of my own views. When I came to Vienna, all my sympathies were exclusively with the pan-German movement. I was impressed by the fact that they had the courage to shout, Heil Hohenzollern, and I rejoiced at their determination to consider themselves an integral part of the German Reich, from which they were only temporarily separated. They never missed an opportunity to explain their attitude in public, which raised my enthusiasm and confidence. To publicly avow one's principles on every problem that concerned Germanism, and to never compromise, seemed to me the only way of saving our people. What I couldn't understand was how this movement declined so soon after such a magnificent start. And it was no less incomprehensible that the Christian socialists should gain such tremendous power within such a short time. They had just reached the pinnacle of their popularity. When I began to compare those two movements, fate gave me the best means of understanding the causes of this puzzling problem, in this case, accelerated by my own sad circumstances. Section 3.19. Schonerer and Luger. I'll begin my analysis with an account of the two men who must be regarded as the founders and leaders of the two movements, George von Schonerer and Dr. Karl Luger. As far as personality goes, both were far above the level and stature of the so-called parliamentary figures. They lived lives of immaculate and irreproachable purity amidst the morass of general political corruption. My initial sympathies lay with the pan-German representative, Schonerer. It was only afterwards, and gradually, that I felt an equal liking for the Christian socialist leader. When I compared their respective abilities, Schonerer seemed to me a better and more profound thinker on fundamental problems. He foresaw the inevitable downfall of the Austrian state more clearly and accurately than anyone else. If this warning to the Habsburg Empire had been heeded in Germany, the disastrous World War, which pitted Germany against the whole of Europe, would never have taken place. But though Schonerer succeeded in penetrating to the essentials of a problem, he was frequently mistaken in his judgment of men. And here, on the other hand, lay Dr. Luger's strength. He had a rare gift of insight into human nature, and he was very careful not to take men as something better than they really were. He based his plans on the practical possibilities that human life offered him, whereas Schonerer had only little understanding in that respect. All ideas that this pan-German had were theoretically right, but he didn't have the forcefulness or understanding necessary to put his ideas across to the broad masses. He was unable to formulate them for the masses, whose powers of comprehension are limited, and will always remain so. Therefore all Schoner's knowledge was only visionary wisdom, he never could succeed in putting it into practice. This lack of insight into human nature led him to err in estimating the forces behind certain movements and the inherent strength of old institutions. Schoner indeed realized that his questions involved the nature of a worldview. But he didn't understand that only the broad masses of a nation can make such convictions, which are almost religious in nature, prevail. Unfortunately, he only poorly understood how weak the fighting spirit of the so-called bourgeoisie is. That weakness is due to their business interests, they are much too afraid of taking risks, and this deters them from acting. And generally speaking, a worldview has no prospect of success unless the broad masses declare themselves ready to act as its standard bearers, and to fight on its behalf, wherever and to whatever degree necessary. This failure to understand the importance of the lower strata of society resulted in a very inadequate conception of the social question. In all this, Dr. Luger was the opposite of Schoner. His profound knowledge of human nature enabled him to correctly judge the various social forces, and it saved him from underrating the power of existing institutions. And it was perhaps this very quality that enabled him to utilize those institutions as a means to serve the purposes of his policy. He saw only too clearly that, in our day, the political fighting power of the upper classes is quite insignificant, it is incapable of fighting for a great new movement until the triumph of that movement is secured. Thus he devoted the larger part of his political activity to the task of winning over those sections of the population whose existence was in danger, and to fostering a militant spirit in them rather than attempting to paralyze it. He was also quick to adopt all available means for winning the support of long-established institutions, in order to derive the greatest possible advantage for his movement from those old sources of power. Thus it was that, first of all, he chose as the social basis of his new party a middle class that was threatened with extinction. He thus secured a solid following, one that was willing to make great sacrifices and had good fighting power. His extremely wise attitude towards the Catholic Church rapidly won over large numbers of younger clergy, so much so that the old clerical party was forced to abandon the field of action or else, which was the wiser course, join the new party, in the hope of gradually winning back one position after another. But it would be a serious injustice to the man if we regarded this as his essential characteristic. For he possessed the qualities of an astute tactician, and had the true genius of a great reformer. But all these were limited by his exact perception of the possibilities at hand, and also of his own capabilities. The goals that this really eminent man decided to pursue were intensely practical. He wished to conquer Vienna, the heart of the monarchy. It was from Vienna that the last pulses of life beat through the diseased, worn-out body of the crumbling empire. If the heart could be made healthier, the other parts of the body were bound to revive. That idea was correct in principle. But the time required to make this happen was strictly limited. And that was the man's weakness. His achievements as mayor of the city of Vienna are immortal, in the best sense of the word. But all that could not save the monarchy, it came too late. His rival, Schoner, saw this more clearly. All of Dr. Luger's practical efforts were marvelously successful, but the hoped-for results never materialized. Schoner failed to attain his goals, but his most terrible fears came true. Thus both these men failed to attain their ultimate objectives. Luger couldn't save Austria, and Schoner couldn't save the German people in Austria from ruin. To study the causes of failure in the case of these two parties is to learn a highly instructive lesson for our own time. This is especially useful for my friends, because in many points the circumstances of our own day are similar to those of that time. Therefore, such a lesson may help us to guard against the mistakes that brought one of those movements to an end, and rendered the other sterile. Section 3.20. The causes of Schoner's failure. In my opinion, the collapse of the Pan-German movement in Austria must be attributed to three causes. First, the leaders didn't have a clear concept of the importance of the social problem, particularly for a new and revolutionary party. Schoner and his followers directed their attention primarily to the bourgeoisie. For that reason, the party was bound to turn out mediocre and tame. The German bourgeoisie, especially in its upper circles, is pacifist even to the point of complete self-abnegation, though some may not be aware of this, wherever the internal affairs of the nation or state are concerned. In good times, which in this case means times of good government, such a psychological attitude makes this class extraordinarily valuable to the state. but when there is bad government, such a quality has a destructive effect. In order to assure the possibility of carrying through a really serious struggle, the Pan-German movement should have devoted its efforts to winning over the masses. The failure to do this left the movement, from the very beginning, without the elemental impulse that such a wave needs if it's not to shortly ebb away. In failing to see the truth of this principle clearly at the very outset of the movement, and in neglecting to put it into practice, the new party made an initial mistake from which it couldn't recover. The numerous moderate bourgeois elements admitted into the movement increasingly determined its internal orientation. This preempted all further prospects of gaining any appreciable support among the masses. Under such conditions, the movement couldn't get beyond mere discussion and criticism. Quasi-religious faith and the spirit of sacrifice were no longer found in the movement. Their place was taken by the effort towards positive collaboration, which in this case meant acknowledging the existing state of affairs. Such a gradual whittling away of the rough corners of the questions in dispute resulted in the making of a dishonorable peace. Such was the fate of the Pan-German movement because, from the start, the leaders didn't realize that the most important condition of success was to recruit their followers from the broad masses. The movement thus became bourgeois and respectable, and only moderately radical. Section 3.21. Pan-Germans and Parliament. From this failure came the second cause of its rapid decline. The position of the Germans in Austria was already desperate when Pan-Germanism arose. Year after year, Parliament was being used more and more as an instrument for the slow destruction of the German-Austrian people. The only hope for an 11th-hour effort to save it lay in the overthrow of the parliamentary system, but there was very little prospect of this happening. Thus the movement was confronted with a question of primary importance. To overthrow the parliament, should the Pan-Germanists have entered it to undermine it from within, as they say? Or should they have attacked the institution as such from the outside? They went in and came out defeated. But they were compelled to enter. In order to wage an effective war against such a power from the outside, indomitable courage and a ready spirit of sacrifice are necessary weapons. In such cases, the bull must be seized by the horns. Furious attacks may drive you to the ground again and again. But if you have a stout heart, you will stand up, perhaps with broken bones. And only after a long and tough struggle will you triumph. New fighters are attracted to a cause by the appeal of great sacrifices made for its sake, until at last tenacity is rewarded with success. For such a result, however, the children of the great masses are necessary. They alone have the requisite determination and tenacity to fight through to the end. But the Pan-German movement didn't have these broad masses, and so the only other solution was to enter Parliament. It would be a mistake to think that this decision resulted from a long series of internal moral hesitations, or that it was the outcome of careful calculation. No, they didn't even consider another solution. Those who participated in this blunder were motivated by vague notions regarding the significance and effect of participating in an institution that they had condemned on principle. In general, they hoped that they would thus be able to promote their cause to the great masses of people, because they could speak before the forum of the whole nation. Also, it seemed reasonable to believe that by attacking the root of the evil, they would be more effective than by attacking from outside. They believed that, if protected by the immunity of Parliament, the position of the individual protagonists would be strengthened, and that therefore the force of their attacks would be enhanced. In reality, everything turned out very differently. The forum before which the Pan-German representative spoke hadn't grown greater, but had actually become smaller. Each spoke only to the circle that was ready to listen to him or could read the report of his speech in the newspapers. But the largest forum of direct listeners isn't the parliamentary auditorium, it's the great public meeting. Here alone there will be thousands of men who have come simply to hear what a speaker has to say, whereas in Parliament only a few hundred are present. For the most part, they are there only to earn their daily attendance fees and not to be enlightened by the wisdom of one of the representatives of the people. Above all, the same public is always present, and it never wishes to learn anything new. Setting aside the question of its intelligence, it lacks even that modest amount of willpower that's necessary for learning. Not one of the people's representatives will honor a superior truth and devote himself to its service. No, not one of them will do this, unless he has grounds for hoping that, by such a conversion, he can retain the representation of his constituency in the coming legislature. Therefore, only when it becomes obvious that the old party is likely to have a bad time at the forthcoming elections, will those models of manly virtue set out in search of a new party or a new policy that may have better electoral prospects. But of course, this change of position will be accompanied by a veritable deluge of high moral justifications. And thus it always happens that, when an existing party has incurred such general disfavor among the public that it is threatened with a crushing defeat, then a great migration begins. The parliamentary rats abandon the party ship. All this happens not because the affected individuals have become better informed on the questions at issue and have resolved to act accordingly. These superficial changes are evidence only of that gift of clairvoyance that warns the parliamentary flea at the right moment, and causes him to hop into another warm party bed. To speak before such a forum signifies casting pearls before a certain well-known animal. It is truly worthless. The result will always be negative. And that's what actually happened. The pan-German deputies could have talked themselves hoarse, but to no result. The press either ignored them totally or so mutilated their speeches that the logical consistency was destroyed, and the meaning twisted around in such a way that the public got the wrong impression of the aims of the new movement. What the individual members said wasn't important. The important matter was what people read as coming from them. This consisted of mere extracts that had been taken out of context, and gave an impression of incoherent nonsense, as was in fact intended. Thus the only public before which they really spoke consisted of a mere 500 parliamentarians, and that says it all. But the worst was the following. The pan-German movement could only hope for success if the leaders realized from the very start that it was not a question of a new party as of a new worldview. This alone could arouse the inner moral forces that were necessary for such a gigantic struggle. And for this struggle, the leaders must be men of first-class minds and indomitable courage. If the struggle on behalf of a worldview is not led by men of heroic spirit who are ready to sacrifice everything, it will soon become impossible to find real warriors who are ready to die for the cause. A man who fights only for his own existence has little remaining for society. In order to secure the requirements for success, everyone concerned must understand that the new movement looks to posterity for its honor and glory, and that it has nothing to offer to present-day members. If a movement offers a large number of positions and offices to be filled, the number of inferior candidates will constantly grow. Eventually, a day will come when there will be such a preponderance of political profiteers that the original combatants will now scarcely recognize their own party. They may even be ejected by the later arrivals as unwanted ballast. At this point, the mission of the movement is lost. Once the pan-Germanists decided to collaborate with Parliament, they were no longer leaders and combatants in a popular movement, but merely parliamentarians. The movement thus sank to the level of a common political party, and no longer had the strength to face a hostile fate and defy the risk of martyrdom. Instead of fighting, the pan-German leaders fell into the habit of talking and negotiating. These new parliamentarians soon found that it was a more satisfactory and less risky way of fulfilling their task to defend their new worldview with the intellectual weapon of parliamentary rhetoric rather than take up a fight in which they would risk their lives. Such a fight would have uncertain outcomes and offer no possibility of personal gain. Section 3.22. The importance of the spoken word. Once they had members in Parliament, their outside supporters hoped and waited for miracles. Of course, no such miracles occurred or could occur. The supporters of the movement soon grew impatient, because reports they read about their own deputies was in no way up to their expectations. The reason for this wasn't hard to find. It was due to the fact that a hostile press failed to give a true account of what the pan-German deputies were actually doing. As the new deputies became accustomed to this mild form of revolution, and to the provincial diets, they gradually became reluctant to resume the more hazardous work of expounding the movement's principles to the broad masses of the people. Mass meetings in public became rarer and rarer, though these are the only means of exercising an effective influence on people. Here, the influence comes from direct personal contact, and earns the support of large numbers. Once the parliamentary platform was substituted for the beer hall table, where thousands were addressed, and once speeches were no longer addressed to the people directly but to the so-called chosen representatives, the pan-German movement lost its popular character. It soon degenerated to the level of an academic discussion club. Thus, the misleading impression created by the press was no longer corrected by personal contact with the people through public meetings, wherein a true account might be given. The end result of this neglect was that the word Pan-German came to have an unpleasant sound in the ears of the masses. The knights of the pen and the literary snobs of today must realize that the great transformations that have taken place in this world were never conducted by a goosequill. No, the task of the pen must always be reserved to that of presenting the theoretical foundations. The force that has ever and always set in motion great historical avalanches of religious and political movements is the magic power of the spoken word. The broad masses of a population are more amenable to the appeal of rhetoric than to any other force. All great movements are popular movements. They are the volcanic eruptions of human passions and emotions, stirred into activity either by the ruthless goddess of distress or by the torch of the spoken word cast into the people's midst. In no case have great movements been set afoot by the syrupy effusions of literary aesthetes and drawing-room heroes. A nation's destiny can be averted only by a storm of hot passion. But only those who are passionate themselves can arouse passion in others. It's only the capacity for passionate feeling that, like hammer blows, will open the door to the hearts of the people. Section 3.23. Effect on the mass. He who is incapable of passionate feeling and speech was never chosen by Providence to proclaim its will. Therefore, a mere writer should stick to his ink bottle and busy himself with theoretical questions, if he has the requisite ability and knowledge. He has been neither born nor chosen to be a leader. A movement that has great ends to achieve must carefully guard against the danger of losing contact with the masses of the people. Every question encountered must be examined primarily from this viewpoint, and the decision to be made must always be accordingly. The movement must avoid everything that might weaken its power of influencing the masses, not from demagogic motives but because of the simple fact that no great idea, no matter how sublime and exalted it may appear, can be realized in practice without the effective power of the popular masses. Hard reality alone must mark the way to the goal. Unwillingness to walk the road of hardship means, only too often in this world, the total renunciation of one's aims and purposes, whether consciously willed or not. As soon as the Pan-German leaders accepted the parliamentary principle and moved the center of their activities away from the people, they sacrificed the future for the sake of a cheap momentary success. They chose the easier way in the struggle, and in doing so rendered themselves unworthy of final victory. While in Vienna, I used to seriously ponder over these two questions. I saw that the main reason for the collapse of the Pan-German movement lay in the fact that these very questions were underappreciated. In my opinion, the movement seemed chosen to lead the German element in Austria. These first two blunders, which led to the downfall of the Pan-German movement, were very closely related. Faulty recognition of the inner driving forces that push great movements forward led to an inadequate appreciation of the part played by the broad masses. The result was that too little attention was given to the social problem, and that attempts to capture the minds of the lower classes were too few and too weak. Another failure was in accepting the parliamentary policy. If there had been a proper appreciation of the tremendous powers of endurance always shown by the masses in revolutionary movements, a different attitude towards the social problem and propaganda would have been taken. The movement center wouldn't have been transferred to Parliament, but would have remained in the workshops and the streets. Section 3.24. The Away from Rome Movement. There was a third mistake, one that also had its roots in the failure to understand the value of the masses. The masses are first set in motion, in a definite direction, by men of superior talents. But once in motion, they are like a flywheel, they sustain the momentum and steady balance of the offensive. The policy of the Pan-German leaders in deciding to carry through a hard struggle against the Catholic Church can be explained only by attributing it to an inadequate understanding of the spiritual nature of the people. The reasons why the new party engaged in a violent campaign against Rome were as follows. As soon as the House of Habsburg had definitely decided to transform Austria into a Slav state, all sorts of means were adopted that seemed to serve that end. The Habsburg rulers had no scruples of conscience about exploiting even religious institutions in the service of this new state idea. One of the many methods thus employed was the use of Czech parishes and their clergy as instruments for spreading Slav hegemony throughout Austria. This proceeding was carried out as follows. Czech priests were appointed in purely German districts. They gradually and steadily pushed forward the interests of the Czech people before those of the Church, and thus became germ cells in the de-Germanization process. Unfortunately, the German-Austrian clergy completely failed to counter this procedure. Not only were they incapable of taking a similar initiative on the German side, but they showed themselves unable to meet the Czech offensive with adequate resistance. Germandom was accordingly pushed backwards, slowly but steadily, through the perversion of religious belief on the one side, and the lack of resistance on the other side. Such tactics were used in dealing with the smaller problems, and in larger matters, the situation was not very different. The anti-German aims pursued by the Habsburgs, especially through the higher clergy, didn't meet with any vigorous resistance, while the clerical representatives of the German interests withdrew completely to the rear. The general impression could only be that the Catholic clergy as such grossly neglected the rights of the German population. Therefore, it looked as if the Catholic Church was not in sympathy with the German people, but rather that it unjustly supported their enemies. The root of the whole evil, especially in Schoner's opinion, lay in the fact that the leadership of the Catholic Church was not in Germany, and that this fact alone accounted for the hostile attitude of the Church towards the interests of our people. The so-called cultural problem receded almost completely into the background, as was generally the case everywhere throughout Austria at that time. In assuming a hostile attitude towards the Catholic Church, the pan-German leaders were influenced not so much by the Church's position on science, etc., but rather because of its failure to defend German rights, and conversely, its aid and support for Slavic arrogance and greed. George Schonerer wasn't a man who did things halfway. He went into battle against the Church because he was convinced that this was the only way to save the German people. The away from Rome movement seemed the most powerful, but at the same time most difficult, way of attacking the adversary's citadel. Schonerer believed that if this movement succeeded, the tragic division between the two great religious denominations in Germany would be wiped out, and the inner forces of the German Reich and nation would be enormously enhanced by such a victory. But both the premise and the conclusion in this case were erroneous. It was undoubtedly true that the national powers of resistance, in everything concerning Germanism as such, were much weaker among the German Catholic clergy than among their non-German brethren, especially the Czechs. And only a fool could be unaware of the fact that it never entered the mind of the German clergy to take the offensive on behalf of German interests. But at the same time, everyone who isn't blind to facts must admit that all this can be attributed to a characteristic under which all we Germans must suffer, that is, the objective way in which we regard our own nationality, along with everything else. While the Czech priest adopted a subjective attitude towards his own people and only an objective attitude towards the Church, the German priest showed a subjective devotion to his Church and remained objective in regard to his nation. This phenomenon, unfortunately, can be found occurring in exactly the same way in thousands of other cases. It is by no means a peculiar legacy from Catholicism, but it is something in us that quickly corrodes almost every institution, especially institutions of state and those that have ideal aims. Take for example the attitude of our state officials in regard to the efforts made for bringing about a national resurgence. Compare this attitude with the stand that the officials of any other nation would have taken in such a case. Or should we believe that the military officers of any other country in the world would refuse to come forward on behalf of national aspirations, and would rather hide behind the phrase, state authority, as has been the case in our country during the last 5 years? Or let us take another example. In regard to the Jewish question, don't both Christian denominations take up a standpoint today that responds to neither national requirements nor to real needs of religion? Compare the attitude of a Jewish rabbi towards any question, even an insignificant one, concerning Jewry as a race, with that of the majority of our clergy, whether Catholic or Protestant. We observe the same phenomenon wherever it is a matter of defending an abstract idea. State authority, democracy, pacifism, international solidarity, etc., all such notions become rigid, dogmatic concepts with us. And the more vital the general necessities of the nation, the more will they be judged exclusively in light of those concepts. This unfortunate habit of looking at all national demands from the viewpoint of a preconceived notion makes it impossible for us to see the subjective side of a thing that objectively contradicts one's own doctrine. It finally leads to a complete reversal of means and ends. Any attempt at a national revival will be opposed if a precondition is that a bad and pernicious regime must first of all be overthrown, Such an action will be considered as a violation of state authority. From this standpoint, state authority is not a means to serve an end, but rather, to the mind of the dogmatic believer in objectivity, an end in itself. He looks upon that as sufficient apology for his own miserable life. Such people would raise an outcry if, for instance, anyone should attempt to set up a dictatorship, even if it were a Frederick the Great, and even though the parliamentary politicians were small and incompetent men. To such sticklers for abstract principles, the law of democracy is more sacred than the welfare of the nation. Accordingly, such men will defend the worst kind of tyranny, though it may be leading a people to ruin, because it is the fleeting embodiment of state authority. Others will reject even a highly beneficent government if it should fall short of their notion of democracy. In the same way, our German pacifist will remain silent while the nation is groaning under oppression by a vicious military power. If this condition calls for active resistance, such resistance means the employment of physical force, which is against the spirit of the pacifist society. The international German socialist may be plundered by his comrades around the world in the name of solidarity, but he responds with fraternal kindness, and never thinks of retribution, or even of self-defense. Simply because he is a German. It may be unpleasant to dwell on such truths, but if something is to be changed, we must first acknowledge it. The same is true with the weak manner in which German interests are promoted and defended by a part of the clergy. Such conduct is not the result of a malicious intent, nor is it the outcome of orders given from above. But such a lack of national determination is due to defects in our educational system. Instead of inculcating a lively sense of German nationality, the aim of the educational system is to make the youth submit to the idea which has become an idol. Education in such abstract notions as democracy, international socialism, pacifism, etc., is so hard and fast and exclusive, and so purely subjective, that they fundamentally influence one's picture of the world. But on the other hand, the attitude towards their own German nationality has been very objective from youth upwards. The pacifist, insofar as he is a German, who surrenders himself subjectively to the dictates of dogmatic principles will always first consider the objective right or wrong of a situation when danger threatens. But he will never take his stand in the ranks of his own people, and fight for them from the sheer instinct of self-preservation. That this also applies to the different religious denominations is shown by the following. Insofar as its origin and tradition are based on German ideals, Protestantism defends those ideals better. But it fails the moment it is called upon to defend national interests, ones that don't belong to the sphere of its ideals and traditional development, or which, for some reason or other, may be rejected by that sphere. Therefore, Protestantism will always take its part in promoting German ideals as concerns moral integrity or national education. When the German spiritual being, or language, or spiritual freedom are to be defended, these represent the principles on which Protestantism itself is grounded. But this same Protestantism violently opposes every attempt to rescue the nation from the clutches of its mortal enemy. The Protestant attitude towards the Jews is more or less rigidly and dogmatically fixed. And yet this is the first problem which has to be solved. Unless all attempts to bring about a German resurgence, or to raise the level of the nation's standing, are to remain senseless and impossible. During my sojourn in Vienna, I had ample leisure time to study this problem without allowing any prejudices to intervene, and in my daily contacts I was able to confirm my view thousands of times. In this focal point of various nationalities, it was quite obvious that the German pacifist was always and exclusively the one who tried to consider his own national interests objectively. But you would never find a Jew who took a similar attitude towards his own people. Furthermore, I found that only the German socialist is international in the sense that he feels himself obliged to demand justice for his own people only by whining and wailing to his international comrades. No one could ever charge the Czechs, or Poles, or other nations with such conduct. In short, I recognized even then that this evil is only partly a result of these doctrines, but mainly the result of our totally inadequate system of education, and its resulting lack of devotion to our own nation. Thus, the first theoretical argument advanced by the pan-German leaders in their offensive against Catholicism was quite untenable. The only way to remedy this evil is to train the Germans from youth upwards to an absolute recognition of the rights of their own people, instead of poisoning their minds with the curse of objectivity, even in matters concerning the very maintenance of our own existence. The result of this would be that the Catholic in Germany, just as in Ireland, Poland, or France, would be a German above all. But all this presupposes a radical change in the national government. The strongest proof of this is supplied by what took place at that historical juncture when our people were last called, before the tribunal of history to defend their own existence in a life or death struggle. As long as there was no lack of leadership, the people overwhelmingly fulfilled their duty and obligations. Whether Protestant pastor or Catholic priest, each did his very utmost in helping our powers of resistance to hold out, not only in the trenches but also, and even more so, at home. During those years, and especially during the first outburst of enthusiasm, in both religious camps there was one undivided and sacred German Reich, for whose preservation and future existence they all prayed to heaven. The Pan-German movement in Austria should have asked itself one question: is the maintenance of Germandom in Austria possible or not, as long as it remains within the fold of the Catholic faith? If yes, then the political party shouldn't have meddled in religious and denominational questions. But if no, then a religious reformation should have been started, and not a political party movement. Anyone who believes that religious reformation can be achieved through the agency of a political organization shows that he has no understanding of the development of religious conceptions and doctrines, and of how these are given practical effect by the Church. No man can serve two masters. And I hold that the foundation or overthrow of a religion has far greater consequences than the foundation or overthrow of a state, let alone a party. It is no counterargument to say that the attacks were only defensive measures against attacks from the other side. Undoubtedly, there have always been unscrupulous rogues who did not hesitate to degrade religion to a tool of politics. Nearly always such a people had nothing else in mind except to make a business of religions and politics. But on the other hand, it would be wrong to hold religion itself, or a religious denomination, responsible for a number of rascals who exploit the Church for their own base interests, just as they would exploit anything else in which they had a part. Nothing could be more to the taste of these parliamentary loungers and tricksters than to find a scapegoat for their political swindling, even after the fact. The moment that religion is attacked and made responsible for his personal misdeeds, this shrewd fellow will raise an outcry at once, and call the world to witness how justified he was in acting as he did, proclaiming that he and his eloquence alone have saved the Church. The public, which is mostly stupid and forgetful, is incapable of recognizing the real instigator of the quarrel in the midst of the ruckus. Frequently it doesn't even remember the beginning of the fight, and so the rogue gets away with his stunt. A cunning fellow of that sort is well aware that his misdeeds have nothing to do with religion. And so he will quietly laugh up his sleeve when his honest but artless opponent loses the game and, eventually losing faith in humanity, resigns from it all. And there is another sense in which it would be wrong to make religion, or the Church per se, responsible for individual misdeeds. If one compares the magnitude of the organization as it appears to all, with the typical weakness of human nature, we will have to admit that the proportion of good to bad is more favorable here than anywhere else. Among the priests there may, of course, be some who use their sacred calling to further their political ambitions. There are clergy who unfortunately forget that in the political struggle they should be the guardians of higher truths and not the abettors of lies and slander. But for each one of these unworthy specimens we can find a thousand or more who fulfill their mission nobly, as the trustworthy guardians of souls, and who tower above the level of our corrupt epoch, as little islands above the morass. I cannot condemn the Church per se, and I would still feel unjustified in doing so if some depraved person in a priest's robe commits some offense against moral law. Nor would I for a moment think of blaming the Church if one of its innumerable members betrays and besmirches his compatriots, especially not at a time when such conduct is quite common. We must not forget, particularly in our day, that for one such effialties there are a thousand whose hearts bleed in sympathy with their people during these years of misfortune, and who, together with the best of our nation, yearn for the hour when fortune will smile on us again. Note: Ephialtes of Trachis, about 480 BC, was an Athenian who betrayed his homeland to the Persians, thus helping them to win the Battle of Thermopylae. End of the note. If it be objected that here we are concerned not with the petty problems of everyday life but principally with fundamental truths and questions of dogma, the only way of answering that objection is to ask a question. Do you feel that fate has called you to proclaim the truth to the world? If so, then go and do it. but have the courage to do it directly, and not use some political party as your mouthpiece, for this is a swindle. For today's evil, substitute your future good. But if you lack the courage, or if your good isn't clear even to yourself, then leave the whole thing alone. But whatever happens, don't try to reach the goal in the roundabout way of a political party if you aren't brave enough to fight with your cap lifted. Political parties have no right to meddle in religious questions, except when these relate to something that is alien to the national well-being, and thus calculated to undermine racial customs and morals. If some church dignitaries should misuse religious ceremonies or religious teaching to injure their own nation, their opponents should never take the same road and fight them with the same weapons. To a political leader, the religious teachings and practices of his people should be sacred and inviolable. Otherwise, he shouldn't be a statesman but a reformer, if he has the necessary qualities for such a task. Any other line of conduct will lead to disaster, especially in Germany. In studying the Pan-German movement and its conflict with Rome, I was then firmly persuaded, and especially in the years to come, of the following conviction: by their failure to understand the importance of the social problem, the Pan-Germanists lost the support of the broad masses, who are the indispensable combatants. By entering Parliament, the Pan-German leaders deprived themselves of the great driving force that resides in the masses, and also took on all the defects of the parliamentary institution. Their struggle against the church made their position impossible in the lower and middle classes, while at the same time it robbed them of innumerable high-class elements, some of the best that the nation possessed. Thus, the outcome of the Austrian Kulturkampf was practically nothing. Although they succeeded in winning 100,000 members away from the church, that didn't cause much harm. The church didn't really need to shed any tears over these lost sheep. It lost only those who had long ago ceased to belong to it in their hearts. The difference between this new Reformation and the Great Reformation was that, in the historic epic of the Great Reformation, some of the best members left the church because of religious convictions. Whereas in this new Reformation, only those left who had been indifferent before and were now influenced by political considerations. From the political point of view alone, the result was as laughable as it was deplorable. Once again, a political movement that had promised so much for the German nation collapsed, because it was not conducted in a spirit of unflinching adherence to naked reality, but rather became lost in fields where it was bound to disintegrate. Section 3.25. Concentration on a single enemy. One thing is certainly true. The Pan-German movement would never have made this mistake if it had properly understood the psyche of the broad masses. If the leaders had known that, for psychological reasons alone, one should never place two or more sets of adversaries before the masses, since that divides their fighting strength, they would have concentrated the full and undivided force of their attack against a single adversary. Nothing in the policy of a political party is so fraught with danger as to allow its decisions to be directed by those jack-of-all-trades who want everything, even though they don't know how to do anything. But even though much can be said against the various religious denominations, political leaders mustn't forget that the experience of history teaches us that no purely political party, in similar circumstances, ever successfully brought about a religious reformation. One doesn't study history for the purpose of later forgetting or mistrusting its lessons. It would be a mistake to believe that in this particular case things were different, so that the eternal truths of history no longer applied. One learns history in order to be able to apply its lessons in the present day, and whoever fails to do this cannot pretend to be a political leader. In reality, he is quite a superficial person or, as is mostly the case, a conceited simpleton whose good intentions cannot make up for his incompetence in practical affairs. The art of leadership, as displayed by all truly great popular leaders of history, consists in focusing the attention of the people against a single adversary, and ensuring that nothing will break it up. The more the militant energies of the people are directed towards one objective, the more will new recruits join the movement, attracted by the magnetism of its unified action. Therefore, the striking power will be all the greater. The leader of genius must have the ability to make different opponents appear as if they belong to one category. Otherwise, weak and wavering followers may easily begin to doubt the justice of their own cause, if they have to face different enemies. As soon as the vacillating masses find themselves facing many enemies, their sense of objectivity will be aroused. They will ask how it is possible that all the others can be wrong, and that they themselves, and their movement, alone are right. Such a feeling would be the first step towards a paralysis of their own power. Hence it will always be necessary to group all opponents together, as forming one solid front, so that the mass of followers will see only one common enemy against whom they have to fight. Such uniformity intensifies their belief in the justice of their own cause, and strengthens their feeling of hostility towards the opponent. The Pan-German movement was unsuccessful because the leaders didn't grasp the significance of that truth. They clearly saw that the goal and their intentions were right, but they took the wrong road. It was like an alpine climber who never loses sight of the peak he wants to reach, and who sets out with the greatest determination and energy, but pays no attention to the road beneath his feet. With his eye always fixed firmly on the goal, he overlooks the nature of the ascent, and finally he fails. Section 3.26. The Way of Christian Socialism. The manner in which the great competitor of the Pan-German Party, the Christian Social Party, set out to attain its goal was quite different. The way it took was correct and well chosen, but it didn't have a clear vision of the goal. In almost all the matters where the Pan-German movement failed, the policy of the Christian Socialist Party was correct and systematic. They assessed the importance of the masses correctly, and thus they gained the support of large numbers by emphasizing the social character of the movement from the very start. By directing their appeal especially to the lower middle class and the artisans, they gained adherents who were faithful, enduring, and self-sacrificing. The Christian Socialist leaders took care to avoid all controversy with the institutions of religion, and thus they secured the support of that mighty organization, the Catholic Church. Those leaders recognized the value of propaganda on a large scale, and they were veritable virtuosos in working up the spiritual instincts of the broad masses of their followers. Section 3.27. Antisemitism on a religious basis. The failure of this party to fulfill its dream of saving Austria from dissolution must be attributed to two main defects in the means they employed, and also the lack of clarity regarding the goal itself. First, the antisemitism of the new movement was based on religious instead of racial principles. The reason for this mistake gave rise to the second error also. The founders of the Christian Socialist Party believed that they couldn't base their position on the racial principle if they wished to save Austria, because they felt that a general disintegration of the state might quickly result. In the opinion of the party chiefs, the situation in Vienna demanded that all factors that tended to estrange the nationalities from one another should be carefully avoided, and that all factors making for unity should be encouraged. At that time, Vienna was so permeated with foreign elements, especially Czechs, that great tolerance was necessary if these elements were to be enlisted in any party that was not anti-German on principle. If Austria was to be saved, those elements were indispensable. And so attempts were made to win the support of the small traders, a great number of whom were Czechs, by combating liberal Manchesterism. And they believed that by adopting this attitude, they had found a slogan against Jewry that would unite all the different nationalities that made up the population of old Austria. It was obvious, however, that this kind of antisemitism didn't upset the Jews very much, simply because it had a purely religious foundation. If worst came to worst, a few drops of baptismal water could always save the Jew and the business at the same time. On such superficial grounds, it was impossible to deal with the whole problem in a serious and rational way. The result was that many people couldn't understand this kind of antisemitism, and therefore refused to join it. The attractive force of the idea was thus restricted exclusively to narrow-minded circles, because the leaders failed to go beyond the mere emotional appeal and didn't ground their position on a truly rational basis. The intellectuals were opposed to such a policy on principle. It looked more and more as if the whole movement was a new attempt to convert the Jews or, on the other hand, as if it merely wished to compete with other movements. Thus the struggle lost all traces of having been organized for a higher spiritual mission. Indeed, it seemed to some people, and these were by no means the worst ones, to be immoral and reprehensible. The movement failed to awaken a belief that this was a problem of vital importance for the whole of humanity, and that the destiny of the whole non-Jewish world depended on a solution. Through this half-hearted approach, the antisemitism of the Christian socialists turned out to be worthless. It was a sham antisemitism, almost worse than none at all. The pretense gave rise to a false sense of security among people, who believed that the enemy had been taken by the ears. But in reality, the people themselves were being led by the nose. The Jew readily adapted to this form of antisemitism. In fact, its continuance was more beneficial to him than its absence would have been. This led to great sacrifices being made for the sake of that multinational state, but much greater sacrifices were required by the German element. One didn't dare to be a nationalist, even in Vienna, lest the ground should fall away from under one's feet. It was hoped that the Habsburg state might be saved by quietly avoiding the nationalist question, but this policy led that state to ruin. The same policy also led to the collapse of Christian socialism, as this movement lost the only source of energy from which a political party can draw the necessary driving force. It became a party like any other. Section 3.28. Pan-Germanism and Christian Socialism. During those years, I carefully followed the two movements and observed how they developed, the one, because my heart was with it, and the other because of my admiration for that remarkable man who then appeared to me as a bitter symbol of all Austrian Germanism. When the imposing funeral procession of the dead mayor wound its way from City Hall towards the Ringstrasse, I stood among the hundreds of thousands who watched it pass by. As I stood there, I felt deeply moved, and my instinct clearly told me that the work of this man was all in vain. A fatal destiny was inexorably leading this state to its downfall. If Dr. Karl Luger had lived in Germany, he would have been ranked among the great leaders of our people. It was a misfortune for his work, and for himself, that he had to live in this impossible state. When he died, a fire had already been kindled in the Balkans, and it was spreading month by month. Fate was merciful in sparing him the sight of that which, even to the end, he had hoped to prevent. I tried to analyze the cause that rendered the one movement futile and wrecked the progress of the other. The outcome was the profound conviction that, apart from the inherent impossibility of bolstering the position of the state in old Austria, the two parties made the following fatal mistake. The Pan-German party was perfectly right in its fundamental ideas regarding its aim, which was to bring about a German Renaissance. But it was unfortunate in its choice of means. It was nationalist, but unfortunately it was not socialistic enough to gain the support of the masses. Its anti-Semitic policy, however, was grounded on a correct perception of the significance of race and not on religious principles. But its struggle against one of the religious denominations was tactically false. The Christian social movement had only a vague concept of a German revival, but it was intelligent and fortunate in its choice of means. The Christian socialists grasped the significance of the social question, but they had wrong ideas in the struggle against Jewry, and had no sense of the power of the nationalistic idea. If only the Christian Socialist Party, together with its shrewd judgment of the worth of the popular masses, had rightly judged the importance of the racial problem, as the Pan-German movement did, and if this party had been really nationalist, then a movement would have developed that, in my opinion, might have successfully altered the course of German destiny. Or if the Pan-German leaders, on the other hand, in addition to their correct judgment of the Jewish question and of the national idea, had adopted the practical wisdom of the Christian Socialist Party, and particularly their attitude towards socialism, the same might have happened. If things didn't turn out this way, the fault primarily lay in the nature of the Austrian state. No other party then in existence supported my convictions, and so I couldn't bring myself to enlist as a member in any of them, or even lend a hand in their struggle. Even at that time, all those organizations seemed to be already exhausted in their energies, and were therefore incapable of bringing about a national revival of the German people in a really profound way, rather than in a merely superficial way. Section 3.29. Growing aversion to the Habsburg state. My inner aversion to the Habsburg state was steadily increasing. The more I paid special attention to questions of foreign policy, the more my conviction grew that this state would surely bring misfortune on the Germans. I realized more and more that the destiny of the German nation couldn't be decisively influenced from here, but only in the German Reich itself. And this was true not only in regard to general political questions but also, and to an equal degree, regarding the whole sphere of cultural life. Here too, in all matters affecting national culture and art, the Austrian state showed all the signs of degeneration, or at least, of ceasing to be of any consequence to the German nation. This was especially true of its architecture. The new architecture couldn't produce any great results in Austria because, since the building of the Ringstrasse, architectural activities, at least in Vienna, became insignificant when compared with the progressive plans arising in Germany. And so I came, more and more, to lead a double life. Reason and reality told me to continue my harsh but beneficial apprenticeship in Austria. But my heart was elsewhere. A growing sense of discontentment made me depressed, the more that I came to realize the inner hollowness of this state, and the impossibility of saving it from collapse. At the same time, I felt perfectly certain that it would bring nothing but misfortune to the German people. I was convinced that the Habsburg state would hinder and oppress every German who might show signs of real greatness, while at the same time, it would aid and abet every non-German activity. I was repelled by the conglomeration of heterogeneous races that the capital of the dual monarchy showed me. This motley crew of Czechs, Poles, Hungarians, Ruthenians, Serbs, and Croats, etc. And above all, that eternal fungus of humanity, Jews and more Jews. The giant city seemed to be the incarnation of racial depravity. The German vernacular of my youth was the local idiom of Lower Bavaria. I never forgot that particular style of speech, and I never learned the Viennese dialect. The longer I lived there, the stronger became my hatred for the mixture of foreign peoples that had begun to erode that ancient ground of German culture. The idea that this state could maintain its existence much longer was quite laughable. Austria was then like an ancient mosaic, one in which the cohesive cement had dried up and become old and crumbly. As long as it remains untouched, it may hold together and continue to exist. But the moment some blow is struck, it then breaks up into a thousand fragments. The question was only when the blow would come. Because my heart was always with the German Reich and not the Austrian monarchy, the hour of Austria's dissolution as a state appeared as only the first step towards the emancipation of the German nation. Section 3.30. The school of my life. All these considerations intensified my desire to go to that country that my heart had been secretly longing for, since the days of my youth. I hoped someday to make my mark as an architect, and that I could devote my talents to the service of my country on a large or small scale, according to the will of fate. But finally I wanted to enjoy the happiness of living and working in the land from which the movement that I had always longed for would be launched, namely, the union of my beloved homeland with our common fatherland, the German Reich. There are many who may not understand how such a yearning can be so strong. But I appeal especially to two groups of people. The first includes all those who are still denied the happiness I have spoken of, and the second embraces those who once enjoyed that happiness but had it cruelly torn from them. I turn to all those who have been torn from their motherland, who have to struggle for the preservation of their sacred language, and who are persecuted and harried because of their loyalty and love for the homeland. To such people I address my words, and I know, they will understand me. Only he who has experienced in his inner being what it means to be German, and yet denied the right of belonging to his fatherland, can appreciate the profound longing caused by enforced exile. It's an eternal heartache, and there's no place for joy and contentment until the doors of the paternal home are thrown open, and all those of kindred blood find peace and tranquility in their common Reich. Vienna was and remains the hardest, though most profound, school of my life. I was scarcely more than a boy when I came to live there, and when I left it, I had grown to be a grave and thoughtful man. In Vienna I acquired the foundations of a worldview, and I developed a faculty for analyzing political questions in particular. That worldview and the political ideas then formed have never been abandoned, though they were later expanded upon in certain directions. Only now can I fully appreciate how valuable those years of study were for me. That's why I have given a detailed account of this period. There, in Vienna, stark reality taught me the truths that now form the fundamental principles of the party that, within the course of 5 years, has grown from modest beginnings to a great mass movement. I don't know what my attitude towards Jewry, social democracy, even more to Marxism in general, to the social problem, etc., would be today, if I hadn't acquired a stock of personal beliefs at such an early age, under the duress of fate, and by my own hard study. For, although the misfortunes of the fatherland may have stimulated many thousands to ponder over the inner causes of the collapse, that couldn't lead to such a thorough knowledge and deep insight as a man may develop, who has fought a hard struggle for many years so that he might be the master of his own destiny.